The number of internet-connected devices is growing, and companies are making a big effort to market them as more than just novel, but necessary. What are we giving up when we embrace the convenience of a smartwatch or a smart fridge? And how much choice will we have to opt out of using these devices as they become more widespread? Joining me now to discuss the Internet of Things is Ian Bogus, a video game designer and a professor of media studies and interactive computing at Georgia Tech. His latest book, Play Anything, The Pleasures of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games, is published by Basic Books. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hey, thank you.
We may know about big companies making devices connected to the internet, an Apple Watch or maybe even a Samsung refrigerator, but aren't there a host of smaller companies doing this too, relying on crowdfunding in some cases to get off the ground?
Right. I mean, crowdfunding or startups or, you know, borrowing a little bit of money and putting together a prototype to make an internet-connected propane tank detector or an internet-connected toaster or an internet-connected gizmo of whatever kind you can almost imagine. You know, the idea of connecting anything whatsoever to the internet has become very popular.
And that propane tank connector, that was the gas watch?
The gas watch. And this is actually a company that makes propane accessories, so it's not an entirely new domain for them.
Well, anyone who has a propane tank does wonder at some time or other, how close am I to empty?
Right.
So that sounds like a good idea. What's the problem?
There's no problem in some sense. All of these products are grounded in some set of ideas or some set of problems that people really do face. How do I know when I've run out of gas? One answer, of course, is, well, you could buy a second propane tank and then you don't have to worry about
it. Or you can look at the meter.
You can look at the meter. There's a trick with hot water that you can look up on YouTube that helps you see where the level is. You can even buy a scale from the same company that makes the internet-connected version, that just tells you, you know, this is a tank that's almost out of gas.
So the way you write about it, you almost seem to be making fun of the concept.
I mean, I think there's a little bit of ribbing that these products have earned. Why does everything need to talk to our smartphones in order to tell us something about the world? And we might pause and observe the fact that we're always looking at those smartphones. So it's not without reason that the companies have pursued our eyeballs there.
Is it still around?
Oh yeah. I mean, the devices, you know, these are things you can buy today, and more of them are coming online, and some of them are getting even more complex and sophisticated. You'll be able to put your whole electric system for your entire house online soon.
What percent of the devices that rely on crowdfunding ever get off the ground?
Well, many of them get started on crowdfunding and don't make it through the crowdfunding process, and then they either die in the vine or they find other sources of funding. And then some of them will, you know, eventually be funded. Whether they make it to market or not is a whole different thing. One of the things that I've observed about the crowdfunding process in general is that it's kind of its own internet-connected entertainment. You're watching these crowdfunding campaigns as though you're watching television.
And some of them probably become successful, but then are gobbled up by a big tech company, which can do the job better than the little independent.
Well, the best example of this in the Internet of Things world is this company called Nest, which Google purchased. And, you know, Nest makes a thermostat, an internet-connected thermostat, and also a smoke detector. And certainly at the time, this idea of, you know, being able to control the temperature in your house from your bed or to be able to have it automatically detect your behavior and adjust accordingly to save you energy, this appealed to a lot of people. But then once it was purchased by Google, folks started scratching their heads wondering, well, do I want Google to know when I'm home? Do I want Google to know when I'm, you know, moving from my bed to my car and doing all these kind of activities that they previously didn't have sensors looking at?
So has that affected business? Because Nest devices seem to be really popular.
Well, they're doing well. I think that most folks have not really caught on to the long-term implications of welcoming these sensors into their homes. And they're very convenient, you know. It's not so much that they're Trojan horses, but they are of a sort.
And that can be a concern. I mean, I don't care if Google knows whether I'm at home or not, but there probably are things that I would prefer nobody know about simply because it's none of their business.
Yeah, these things sneak up on us, too. We don't necessarily know the implications of Google knowing when you're home or what else Google might be able to intuit
and
about
how do
your
you,
world.
How do you imagine Google would even use the data from Nest?
Well, for example, if it, you know, begin to build a model of behavior inside the home and then match that behavior to what Google also knows about your internet usage, this is where things really become concerning. And also remember that Google in some municipalities and some cities is offering fiber internet service, so they have the capacity at least not just to know what you're searching for, but also to know every website you're visiting, everything that you're doing. And it's not so much that Google is monitoring or is sort of publishing what they're doing with all this information, but beginning to triangulate people's behavior. It's not just a privacy concern. It also may have an effect on what we can see or what we are shown, what our kind of perspective on what's available to us in the world looks like.
So should I instead be using Bing or Yahoo as a search engine?
Well, you know, there
Or is it all the same?
There are search engines that you can use that will kind of hide your internet address if you're concerned about this. But, you know, another way to look at it is, should you be using Nest in the first place? And you can get many of the benefits of a device like this with a non-internet-connected programmable thermostat. There are some things that it won't do, but in many cases, the same kind of energy savings, for example, are afforded by that ordinary thermostat you probably already have.
So many people rely on things like this. You can set the alarm on your house from your phone.
Right, or you can
and
turn
from
the lights
wherever
on.
You are. Yeah. You could be in Europe and you can start the alarm because you're away.
Right, and one thing that's been interesting to me is the kinds of products that have been around for a long time that folks have forgotten about or aren't aware of. I've got a monitor, a timer, that's just internal electronics. It doesn't connect to the internet. It turns my porch light on and off with the sunrise and sunset. It changes by daylight savings time. It adjusts to the time of year. You know, it's a $30 device that doesn't require the internet at all.
My guest is Ian Bogost, B-O-G-O-S-T. His book, Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, The Secret of Games. It's published by Basic Books. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've also written that the Internet of Things, and we should talk about that, is a collective hallucination in which we dream about possible future products instead of experiencing them. That was last year. Has anything changed since?
I think one of the things that's changed is that it's accelerated to the point now that we kind of desire our devices to be connected to the Internet. You know, when you stop, I know this is going to sound absurd, when you stop and you look at an appliance in your home, you know, your toaster, perhaps, you almost wish it could go online. We have this very fond association.
For what reason?
Part of it is to become further connected to the things in our world, because one of the ways that we have identified connectivity with one another, with each other as human beings, is through the Internet. And when you can connect to your toaster over the internet or your thermostat, or I know it sounds ridiculous, or your lights, and you can do that from afar, you're also developing that same kind of relationship with those objects.
Because I have drawn the line with refrigerators, toasters, stoves, and other things. I just am trusting, you know, I'm trusting in a way that I trust when I get a lot of type from Apple that I don't read and I say I accept at the end.
Right. You know, part of what we don't know is what these devices are doing, or if they even know. There's been security holes and exploits for them, and they can become
somebody can
agents.
Hack my refrigerator?
Yeah. Somebody can hack your refrigerator, and it can become a part of a botnet that's sending spam elsewhere. So that's one concern that's different from the privacy issue.
One common critique of the products that come out of Silicon Valley is that they are targeted mainly to the kinds of people who create them, young, well-off white males. Is that also true of the market for the Internet of Things?
I think the Internet in general, and certainly the Internet of Things, is largely designed by well-off young males, and it's almost as though we're fashioning the world in that image. The dream of making things, of changing the world by making things internet connected so that you can better manage your life, already assumes that the way that you would want to manage your life is via the internet.
Where did the whole concept of the Internet of Things come from?
Well, many years ago, there was this concept called ubiquitous computing, which arose in computer science circles. And the notion of ubiquitous computing, just as it sounds, is computers are eventually going to become smaller. Are they going to become cheaper? Are they going to be embeddable in a variety of different situations in the world and not just be these beige or black boxes that sit on desks or in server rooms? And that once that happens, we'll be able to accomplish different kinds of goals than we're able to do with computers when they're locked up, when they're just tools of the workplace.
And that's happened.
It's happened, essentially, although what's different in what the UbiComp, as it's sometimes abbreviated, what the UbiComp proponents didn't necessarily anticipate is the way that the ubiquitous computer would become interconnected to the broader business of online services.
Some of the ideas strike me as a bit crazy. Like, wasn't there a robotic office plant?
Yeah, this is kind of an art project, an office plant that looks at your emails for the sentiments that are being expressed in them and wilts or sits up erect based on its analysis of kind of how the people you're communicating with are feeling.
Would the fitness tracker fall into this kind of category?
Fitness trackers, you know, internet-connected refrigerators, in some ways you can call them all ubiquitous computing affairs, but there's obviously quite a bit of difference between something like a robot plant, which is this ambient device, this kind of alien presence that's there to be something other, something that is neither a plant nor a computer.
But a novelty.
A novelty, to be sure. It's And many of the ubiquitous computing projects were kind of art objects or novelties. They were experiments. They were mostly pursued in research labs at universities and corporations with the idea that, commercialization was not a primary concern. And, at the time, it was more a question of, well, what is the world going to be like once we have computers everywhere?
The devices are marketed as ways to make your life easier. Do you think that it's true?
It depends on what you mean by make your life easier. And one of the things they certainly do is make it much easier to connect to your devices through other devices. As to whether they help people accomplish their goals, I think we have to ask what kind of goals people have.
Well, they're talking about convenience.
Yeah, but it's a certain kind of convenience. And I have the suspicion that many of the conveniences that we take for granted, we wouldn't necessarily have pursued as conveniences some years ago. The idea of not having to get out of your bed in order to change the temperature in the room by adjusting your thermostat on your phone, it is a convenience. There's no doubt about it. But the alternatives, which, programming it to change the temperature every night accordingly, are not that much less convenient, really, which makes me suspect that the biggest convenience we want to derive from these Internet of Things devices is that idea of communion with them through computers, kind of connecting things in our world through these computational devices that serve as our window onto the world more and more.
And then, as you suggested earlier when we were talking about Google, it also is a way that these companies can collect data on us.
Yeah, enormous
amount
of data.
How would they use the data that they collect from whether I change the temperature in my bedroom?
Well, one of the interesting things about data is that we don't know exactly what it tells about us when it's aggregated all together, and especially when sophisticated machine learning algorithms can churn on not just your or my data, but everyone's data, and intuit what those patterns are suggestive of. So we might, for example, be able to, in the future, kind of correlate between preferences for a temperature setting in a particular part of your house and other sorts of behaviors based on what a company like Google is able to determine people actually do.
And there's that often cited situation where families suddenly started getting all these ads for pregnant women, and they had no idea why they were coming until they realized that Target was evaluating all of the purchases of their teenage daughter.
Right, right. The advertising endpoint is the one we talk about the most. The idea that you can serve more targeted ads, and the Target example was, a very evocative notion of that, because it unveiled this surprise that the family didn't know or wasn't public within the household.
The daughter wasn't talking about it.
Right, right. And it's almost too clean an example, though, because what really tends to happen if you look at the ads you get is that they appear to be totally unrelated to many of your interests, or, you look at a web page because you need to buy a particular good, and then you see it everywhere else online. So while ad targeting is often talked about as the kind of endpoint of all this data collection, there's much murkier, kind of stranger ways that we can be profiled, which are then sold, to other organizations, maybe for like insurance underwriting, for example.
How accurate are they? For example, the algorithms that decide that Netflix suggests that I'd be interested in a certain film that I am absolutely not interested in, or that Amazon thinks I might be interested in a certain book that I'm not interested in. Obviously, they're based on some pretty sophisticated mathematics.
In a certain sense, the question of how how well they work is maybe less important than how much we believe in them, and maybe more important than that, how much organizations believe in them. This gets back to that idea of the collective hallucination. So something like television ratings are also based on incomplete data. And, you know, as organizations, especially like, you know, insurance companies, employers start to look at data to make judgments about, you know, the employability or the underwritability of an individual, whether or not those patterns describe their future actions are less important than the collective picture that they use to make those decisions.
Is it possible to buy a TV set these days that isn't connected to the internet?
It's become very hard. You can certainly choose not to connect your television to your Wi-Fi or to your wired-in internet, but then you may not be able to use all its features if you want to watch Netflix or Hulu or something like that, which more and more people are doing. Then inevitably you have to connect it to the internet. And then once you connect your television, sometimes they do strange things, like perhaps listen in on your conversations. Or
they really can. Who would be listening in? If the NSA listens in on my conversations, they're going to be really disappointed.
Absolutely. And, you know, some of these stories are surely apocryphal. Some of them are true. But, you know, we've seen evidence that, for example, the Facebook mobile messenger app kind of has its microphone active, is waiting for you to activate it, and what it's collecting behind the scenes, we don't really know. You know, the same thing with your TV. At the very least, it can know what you're watching and how long it's on and what times of day.
My guest is Ian Bogost, who is the Ivan Allen College Distinguished Chair in Media Studies and a Professor of Interactive Computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology, Georgia Tech. His book, Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games, is published by Basic Books. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Ian Bogost. His book, Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games, is published by Basic Books. Design doesn't just refer to the outside of a device, but to the software as well. And now the term user experience is becoming more and more popular. Many people it's likely that many people don't know what that means. Can you talk a little bit about the field of user experience?
Right. So, you know, for years we had user interface design, and that was connected to the idea of the, you know, the coupling between the human and the computer. We also have seen human factors engineering, ergonomics, you know, such that your chair feels comfortable and you can sit in it all day without injuring yourself.
But didn't that go all the way back to Eames way before
goes,
we had
goes
computers?
Goes all the way back. And you know, it's all about the way that you can operate a device. But it doesn't speak necessarily to the experience that you have with it, what it means to kind of feel connected to a product or service, or to have a sense of what it does in your life. So user experience design arose several years ago as a way of trying to expand the concerns of design just from the interface to the whole process of acquisition, ownership, and use. One of the classic user experience, or UX as it's sometimes abbreviated, examples is that when you buy a piece of electronics, a mobile phone or something, you take it out of the box and it's charged so you can use it right away. So you don't have to wait for it to charge up at home. And even the unboxing portion of the experience, you know, can be a pleasurable one where the delight of seeing it for the first time is now taken into account. Not to mention the way that it fits into the rest of your life, you know, the way that that it sits in your desk or the way that it fits in your pocket, those sorts of issues.
One product that you reviewed that seems a bit retro is a smart typewriter.
A smart typewriter, yeah, definitely retro. You know, there's certainly an accusation of hipsterdom that this device is perhaps going to receive.
Designed to provide a distraction-free writing space? What does that mean?
So, you know, we've had many examples of distraction on our computers. And for writers like myself, you know, you can't go a minute at your word processor without Twitter or Facebook or something tempting you to go elsewhere. And this device, this smart typewriter, it looks like a typewriter. It doesn't have a computer screen. It just has an e-ink screen like a e-book reader. It's completely disconnected from your computer, although it can connect to the internet over Wi-Fi. You use it like a typewriter, and all it does is take textual input. It saves it. Doesn't even really let you use the arrow keys that you're familiar with to go back and correct something. You can just use the backspace. So the attempt here is to recreate the experience of writing in a purer way that eliminates all of the distractions of the computer.
Well, some have argued that the quality and content of writing changed when we started using word processors and computers.
It's certainly true that all the tools that we use alter the work that we do. And it doesn't matter if that's a word processor or a typewriter or a mobile phone or even just the pen and paper that we would use in a different context. And when I was using this this smart typewriter, one of the things that I noticed most was that because it's small and flat, you could sit in your lap or sit in the desk, and because I can touch type, I was looking around my environment. You can take it outside, too. Its battery lasts a very long time. You can take it to the beach or to the cabin or what have you. And that experience of typing while looking up, and not at a screen, but just looking out at the world, certainly changed. I can imagine I would change my perspective as a writer. You know, that I'm seeing something that I'm either writing about or that is informing the state of mind that I'm in when I'm writing, rather than all that I see is the computer interface.
So, is that providing a distraction-free experience?
Well, I don't know that this sales
it seems
pitch
to be
of,
just distracting, being here, distracted in a
beach.
Different way.
Yeah,
you're
exactly.
Looking at the flowers.
Honestly, I think the distraction-free sales pitch is one that we expect to hear, but is not the most interesting thing about a product like this. What's really interesting is to reframe the writing experience, to give the writer a sense of a different way of writing. This is not what you're going to do that's going to save your novel from missing its deadline. It's rather a different mode of writing, just as walking and running and driving in a car are different ways of traveling.
Well, does it feel pure? Because I guess the ultimate pure experience would be writing it out in longhand.
I mean, certainly there's this dream of purity, but then no one wants to write something out longhand. And if you do, then the experience of what you write and your exhaustion and the kind of physical experience of holding the pen, all of those things are going to change what you write about. So we don't get a purer writing. What we get is one that's assisted by different kinds of tools in different ways.
You're not only a professor and a writer, but as I said in my introduction, you are also a video game designer. When did you start designing video games?
Well, as a kid, I was interested in games and designed a couple of games. But I got into game design as a kind of practice in the mid '90s, right as the internet was starting up. And one of my interests for many years now has been games that do things outside of entertainment. You know, that work in education, in politics, in business. And that was when I first started that up in the world of advertising, which is maybe not as exciting and dramatic as learning or activism, but suggested a different kind of use of games than just for distraction.
How does that work in advertising? I started my career in advertising, and the whole thing has changed an awful lot. We used to have a layout, and then somebody would write copy, and we'd send it off to a type shop. Somebody else would do engravings, and an ad would be put together.
Right.
None of that happens anymore. You do it all within a computer.
You do it all within the computer, and then you can create traditional ads within the computer. But now, of course, we have these interactive experiences in apps, or back then in websites. And so once you have interactivity, at least this was my premise, then the capacity for the advertisement to demonstrate something about the product or service itself, to kind of simulate what an experience of having a SUV with three rows of seats that you can reconfigure to haul your family or your soccer team around. This would be something you could actually test out and try out. What eventually happens in advertising is that we focus on these appeals to emotion or affinity, the dream that I have about who I might be, and I get the off-road vehicle not because I'm going to go camping, but because I fancy that I'm the kind of person who might. And games had this is my premise at least, had the capacity to reintroduce some of that form and function of products and services back into the marketing process.
What kinds of games are you designing that work in politics?
Well, I have the interesting distinction of having co-designed the first ever game for a American presidential candidate for Howard Dean back in 2003, which seems like an eternity.
It didn't seem to work all that well for Howard Dean.
It's interesting. The game that we made for the campaign was all about grassroots outreach, which was, of course, the whole premise of that campaign, which then crashed and burned after the Iowa caucus. And the game was prepared kind of around that theme. And through the observations we made with the game, which is, how do you get involved? How do you help people kind of learn to caucus and hand out flyers? All the stuff they were focusing on with blogs and meetups and so forth. one of the things we saw when folks played it is they were commenting, you know, this is interesting. This gives me a concrete understanding of how to do some of these abstractions that I've been reading about. But I'm just wondering, what is it all for? Where are the policy positions for this campaign going to come from? We have to do something more than outreach at some point. That was back in December of 2003, about a month before the campaign kind of blew up. So we did have some signals, you know, via the game, not in the game, but through what it facilitated, that of where the campaign needed to go in order to succeed.
Has it been applied to other campaigns?
Well, the uses of games in political campaigns has kind of fallen by the wayside in favor of first video and then social media and so forth. And, you know, the idea, and I pursued this in other games that I thought was more promising, was not so much campaigning, but policy, the representation of policy by modeling proposed ideas for legislation in game form. I'll give you one example that we worked on that the New York Times published a number of years ago, back during the McCain-Kennedy immigration bill, the so-called points-based green card award system. So that was an example where we took this legislation, which was concrete but many, many hundreds of pages long, and created this little model of it in a game such that the citizen could experience what the legislation was proposing.
We would hope that some people in Congress would also play that game, because most of them seem to vote on bills without having read them.
Well, and most of our
understanding
what
the bills involve.
I mean, in general, our relationship with politics is one of politicking rather than policy, which is too bad.
Ian Bogost is my guest. His book, Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games. For most people, games would really mean something like Grand Theft Auto, which glorifies violence. What's your take on something like Grand Theft Auto?
Well, there's lots of different kinds of games. And there's the games that we think of when we think of video games, and then there's the games we think of the most when we think of video games, something like Grand Theft Auto. But, you know, the idea that a game is a model of something, a game is a set of designed or accidental limits and constraints, and that we subject ourselves to that experience when we play a game. This applies to, you know, a board game like Scrabble. It applies to sport like soccer or football, and it applies to a complex 3D world like Grand Theft Auto, where there's certain kinds of actions you can perform and others that you can't. And certainly these are different games performing different kinds of effort, doing different things. Some of them are physical, some of them are mental or intellectual, some of them are about recreating narrative experiences. But, you know, one of the things I try to do in this new book, in Play Anything, is to take games not as an end goal so much, but a place where there are models of that process of training ourselves to see these limits and restrictions and use them elsewhere.
Many people only see negative things in games. There was a documentary recently about kids, I think Chinese kids, Korean kids, who became addicted to games and didn't go to school, didn't do anything else, stayed up all night just playing the games. Why are some of them so addictive?
Well, there's something compelling. There's a kind of like black magic in games that we've known about for a long time. You know, why is it that we can play a game for so many hours again and again? Or why do we want to return to even a simple game like Pac-Man or even a game like Tetris, which everyone has played, and you can kind of get compelled by so much that you see it in your sleep. And that compulsion, though, I don't think is unique by any means to games. We have that same kind of reaction to social media or other kinds of media today. So it's somewhat unfair to put all the blame on games specifically.
And some artists have actually used games as a way of making pieces.
Yeah, and we've also seen games, virtual reality games now are being used for pain treatment. There's all sorts of applications of games, and it goes far beyond just the first impression that you have, which is Grand Theft Auto or Tetris.
When the first line of the Toyota Prius came out, some people mentioned that the bar that showed fuel efficiency went up and down depending on how you drove felt like a game.
Right, and I think what they really meant is that it gave them feedback. There's a device that's giving you feedback, that's showing you something about the system and how it's behaving. And this is a feature of many games. They tell you a lot about what's going on internally and allow you to then respond in your actions in the games. But that use of feedback extends, of course, far beyond games specifically.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I have to talk a bit about phones, cell phones, mm-hmm. because you can't enter an elevator in this building without noticing that everybody else in the elevator is looking at his or her phone. On the subway, we have people looking at playing games on their phones, picking out the music they're listening to on their phones. First of all, what do you think about the new iPhone 7 and the fact that Apple has called its decision to remove the headphone jack courageous?
Well, certainly courageous from the perspective of their business. Whether it's courageous at a kind of cultural level has, of course, been the subject of some mockery.
Well, it's forcing people to buy new headphones.
It's forcing people to buy new headphones. And if you have, you know, if you have an automobile where you've been plugging in to the sound system while also charging, you won't be able to do that. But this is not the first time that Apple has forced one of these changes upon its users. We can look at the removal of the floppy disk drive in 1998, and then the removal of the CD or optical drive in laptops starting in 2008. And Apple is, you know, sort of known, this is why they made this claim to courage, sort of known for forging new paths into the future. And then when we are subject to that future, when we live in it, we acclimate to it. And we think, well, that's not so bad. I don't really need a floppy drive anyway. Or, yeah, it's okay. I don't need a disk. I can get my software from an app store. But we fail to think about how things might have been different.
How much of this involves the sense of play? Your book is called Play Anything. Do you think that Apple purposely puts play into its, or thinks about play when it's developing its devices?
Well, you know, the idea that most people think of when they think of play is that it's something other than work, or it's, you know, it's leisure. It's something that you choose to do rather than something that you have to do. And one of the ways I reframe this notion in the book is that play isn't so much in you as it is in the things around you. Like there's play in a mechanism, like a steering column, and it, you know, has a little bit of flexibility or movement before it engages. And in that respect, these electronics, these products, the Internet of Things devices, all the stuff we've been talking about has play in it. They allow us to do certain things, and they also allow us to choose not to do others.
But it's also perhaps an explanation for their appeal for children.
Well, I think it's important that we separate play from children's activities, or play from sort of, you know, off the books kind of work, and think of play not as this thing that kids do that adults would like to do, but rather this thing that is in things that we can engage in with anything.
Well, every kid wants to play with your cell phone. Ian Bogus. Book is Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, The Secret of Games. It is published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being on our show
today. Thank you so much.